Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
And today we have a very interesting program lined up. I'm still waiting for my guest, Stephen Katz. He's supposed to be on our show today. We have a very interesting show that we will be presenting to our listeners today. And Ruth Ann, is Stephen, is he with us yet?
Nope. No Stephen.
Okay. Our program today, what we are discussing with Stephen is fabricating a case for war. And in our segment today, we're going to be taking a glimpse at the 200 years of conflicts that the U.S. Has been involved in. In addition to that, how the country went from being, the U.S. went from being an isolationist country to interventionist, and now they're the masters of global imperialism. Of course, when we look at the history of the United States, we realize that the U.S. has never really been an isolationist country. Many millions of people were led to believe, the citizens of the country were led to believe that we were a country that did not want to be involved in many of the international affairs.
I must interrupt.
However,
Steve Katz here.
Yeah.
Oh, hi, how are you doing, Stephen?
Good.
I'm glad to have you joining the program. And as I mentioned before World War II, millions of Americans were being led to believe that we were an isolationist country. But Stephen is going to share with us today how over the years we have been involved in many conflicts, including when it was before the American Civil War with the French and the British, how eventually it was American Revolution between the colonists and Great Britain. It was wars and conflicts, even the United States when they were in war with France. Also, many of the conflicts and wars, I should say conflicts in Morocco, Algiers, and many parts of Africa. More recently, we have seen that the United States has been very involved in many conflicts throughout the world. More recently, Vietnam, we can see what happened in Iraq, Afghanistan, and now it is going throughout many parts of Africa, the Middle East, and now in Europe. So Stephen is going to discuss many of those areas with us today. Stephen, what I would like for you to do is you have a new program now. Could you share
Yes.
with our listeners first, and then we'll get into the program today, what is your program about? Give us the name and tell us a little bit about your program.
Well, this is a new program, UFOs, Mystical and Paranormal Insights. And the program deals with the realm of metaphysics and also UFO sightings, and we examine these phenomena and possible explanations. And you know, it's a program dedicated to the what I call this the quest for new knowledge, trying to figure out the unknown and you know, the role it plays in our lives.
I understand. And when does the program come on, Stephen?
The program is Thursday at 5 o'clock Eastern Standard.
Thursday
time.
At 5 o'clock. Okay.
Easter.
And who are your guests? What type of guests do you have coming on? Obviously, I wouldn't be qualified to be on that program. Well, who are you, Gary? I'm very interested in that.
Yeah, I mean, you should call in. I mean, it's whoever comes on, or you know, are people who have these experiences. You don't have to be an expert because, as I pointed out, there are no experts in this field because it's new and it's just developing. But there are people with knowledge about it. And one person that I hope to have on is Peter Robbins, who has dedicated his life to the investigation of UFO phenomena. And he wrote a book in 1982 with Larry Warren called Left at Eastgate, about one of the most famous sightings and experiences which took place on at a joint U.S.-British air base near Rambleshan Forest, or in Rambleshan Forest, in Great Britain, which was really amazing. And anybody who has had any experience in this area should certainly come on. People have experiences with demonic possession, ghosts, so-called, which are actually spiritual energy bodies which are attached to specific areas, usually for certain reasons, and also mysticism, which is a the classical definition of mysticism is a personal or existential experience with the divine or God, as opposed to secondary like intellectual analysis of sacred writings and so on. So there's a lot of different areas for us to go into, and politics does play a role, as it does in everything, in the sense that our government, as well as many other governments, are sequestering information about various things from the general public. Sometimes they think for our own good, sometimes because they want to use these the knowledge that they can gain in order to create new weapons. And there have been many instances of cover-up. So this is the universe of discourse, so to speak.
Well, Stephen, we're definitely looking forward to your program, and I encourage our listeners to tune into your program on a weekly basis, where they can be able to share and also receive additional information in regards to what your program will have to offer.
Right.
And Stephen, we're going to get into our program today. As I mentioned, we're in some very critical times here in this country, very critical. And I believe much of it is tied into global capitalism, is also tied into the global economic crisis that we're in. We never came out of this crisis. It's also tied into the way the capitalists try to and attempt, and they do, they accomplish the exploitation of the natural resources, human resources of the planet, and ultimately to dominate all the resources of the world for their own profit, gain, and power. And that's what we're looking at today, Stephen, because when we look at what has taken place in Africa, what has taken place on all the continents, including what has taken place right there in Europe right now, we can see that that what is taking place in regards to in the Ukraine, this is propaganda being being used to the nth degree. In addition to that, we can see that a case for war is being fabricated, where potentially it can take us into a global war. But this is nothing new, Stephen. We can see that this country has been involved in more than 200 wars and conflicts over the last 200 years. Could you just share a little bit about many of these conflicts and wars that this country has been involved in, even before the American the Revolutionary War?
Well, I mean, you know, it's ironic that a country which started out right after its establishment in, I think it was Washington's farewell address, in which he warned about foreign entanglements. But in the beginning, we had kind of a mercantile economy. We had not reached into full-blown industrial capitalism. I suppose you could count the United States as one of the leading war-making countries in the history of the world. Probably have to go back to Rome to find anything similar to it, or certainly ancient times in terms of the frequency of conflicts. But here, even before the Civil War, we had a war with Mexico in which we confiscated quite a lot of territory from Mexico. And
now that was the Mexican-American War. That was a Mexican-American War, which was before the Civil War.
Right. And there was, of course, we had our own Civil War here. But after the Civil War and when the economy became more and more industrialized and capitalism established itself more and more, of course, world markets grew, and there were other powers in the world contending for raw materials, cheap labor, and so on and so forth. Conflict grew, and we had the Spanish-American War. There's thought that the war that was the Spanish-American War, which resulted in the annexation of Cuba as a U.S. protectorate, was initially instigated by the sinking of a U.S. warship, and there have been reports that it was staged in order to give an excuse to attack the Spanish Empire and to acquire the Philippines. And that was one of the early examples of how this went. And there has been an isolationist streak in the country. Now, I think everybody rationally will recognize that society has to have ways of domestically protecting its citizens from bodily harm and the confiscation of their personal material wealth or means of survival and so on, and an army to protect it from invasions of some type. As the economy expanded, all of this changed, and, as the U.S. became world power, more and more conflicts came on. It has been very common, in order to mobilize the population behind wars in which there is no immediate impact. I mean, if a country is invaded, the people in the country, they don't need to be subjected to a lot of propaganda to fight, because they see it, and they're fighting for their homes, their lives, their loved ones, and their economic organizations and means of survival. And, there isn't really much propaganda needed. But if money and troops have to be raised to be sent overseas or involved in conflicts quite a distance away, some reason must be either fabricated or created or explained to justify this. And
right.
One thing we have to remember is that imperialist war is big business. And
right.
The armaments industry, you know.
Well, that's a good point that you're bringing up right there, because when you talk about these wars, Stephen, very good point when you say it's big business, because we understand that in war, the banks, they finance both sides. They both sides of the conflict, both sides of the war. The same thing happened in Germany, where they were financing both sides of the war. The same thing happened when it was the war with Britain and the colonies. They were financing both sides of the war. The same thing happened when it was, you know, when we were fighting in the Vietnam War. Because a lot of times, Stephen, you had to understand, like, how are these people that are a poor nation, next thing you know, you see a guy walking around with some weapons on his shoulder that's like around $30,000. Like, where did you get that from? You know.
Right.
But, you know, in when we're looking at wars, Stephen, it's big business, not only for the industrialists in the military-industrial complex, but it's big business for banks, too.
Yes.
But expand on that, how it's big business for, you know, war creates, for the capitalists, it creates good business, is good for business.
Well, I mean, of course, you know, you have to equip armies, and that requires the production of vehicles and weapons of all types. Yeah, contractors have to be hired to, you know, create clothing, and, you know, you have the Navy, Air Force. All of these fields expand, and frequently the top echelon of the armed forces will then eventually go onto the boards of the arms makers, you know, when they retire, and it's kind of an incestuous relationship. And, you know, I believe the U.S. sells more weapons to more countries in the world than any other country. Last time I checked, and...
last time you checked, you received accurate information.
Yes. And, you know, this, of course... And the monies where do the monies come from? They come from wealth which is created by the civilian population, by working people, and you know, that through taxation and so on, it's taken and given to the arms makers and the arms forces and so on and so forth. Now, like I said, you know, when you get beyond the rational necessity for a certain amount of armament in the world as it is, then you get into the imperialist armaments. And in the, for instance, in the Vietnam War, contractors had to be brought in to build airfields in South Vietnam. They had to be brought in to build a harbor or ocean facilities so that warships could dock, and that you know, a tremendous amount of wealth. And has been speculated that one of the reasons that Kennedy was assassinated is because he had planned on withdrawing troops from Vietnam and did not want to get involved in a war there.
Let's talk about Kennedy's involvement in that. We know that he was voted into office in 1960, and shortly in 1963 he was assassinated.
Yes.
Now we can see that war, the United States, and much of this the public don't understand, is that they were thinking that it was North and South, but first of all, Americans received a slew of lies from the media and the propaganda machine here in this country that the United States, the Gulf of Tonkin, what had taken place there, giving us cause to get involved in that war. But in addition to that, Kennedy inherited that war. He inherited that conflict, which in 1960, I mean, shortly after he got in office, you could see that he was moving away from wanting to get any further U.S. involvement in that war.
Yes.
We could see it came to a point. The U.S. became very much involved with the boots on the ground in 1965. That's why they call it a 10-year war. But, Stephen, I just want you to elaborate on that, why it was so important for us to understand the propaganda that took place, even around the assassination of a president, so that we could go into war. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Yes, there was quite a conflict that broke out between the Kennedy and the Kennedy administration and the top echelon of the military in the United States, the Joint Chiefs of Staff and so on. And he got into office. He had several situations to contend with. One was the fact that they had already been training anti-Castro Cubans to launch an invasion into Cuba. This was being run by the CIA with the help of the Mafia. The Mafia had a lot of investments which were confiscated in Cuba, including casinos, houses of prostitution, and also what we would consider to be legitimate businesses, fishing or whatever. I say legitimate because it's a more or less mainline type of business, or whether it was sugar or what have you. And, the invasion was launched in April of 1961, and Kennedy, and of course Castro and Che Guevara and the other Cuban revolutionaries were ready for this invasion, and they expected it, and the troops that landed there had a very rough time, and they were getting beaten, and Kennedy refused to send in a backup contingent of U.S. air power, as well as additional anti-Castro forces, Cuban forces. And he said, no, I'm not going to do that. And so that was something that aroused a great deal of anger. There was a revolution in Laos. The Pathet Lao, who were communists, were fighting to overthrow a CIA-installed government there, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Army and so on and the CIA were trying to get him to commit troops there, and he refused. And then we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, in which the military-industrial complex from day one wanted to use it as a pretext or as a reason to invade the island. And there again, he sought for some sort of negotiated settlement. And now, according to the research which I have done on this, which has become quite extensive in recent years, the there was a tremendous amount of money to be made in Vietnam, in the war in Vietnam, constructing these facilities and, you know, manufacturing these helicopters and bombers and outfitting the army and all these armaments and everything. And that was a group that was very unhappy about Kennedy's national security memorandum, which was executed just a few months before he was killed, in which he said by the end of 1965, you know, all troops will be withdrawn from Vietnam. And I believe that this was I believe that this was going to be one of his major campaign pledges in the election in 1964. And, of course, the mafia had lost millions of dollars, as well as other entities that had businesses in Cuba due to the confiscation by the revolutionary government over there of these businesses and closing them. I mean, they closed them down. And they were not happy about this either. And so there was a book written by a guy named Fletcher Prouty, who was a very high-ranking military intelligence guy during this period, who verified the involvement of the CIA and military intelligence in the assassination of President Kennedy, as well as the verification now of the U.S. House of Representatives had a committee on assassinations in the mid-70s. They verified mafia involvement. The mafia and the CIA were working very closely together to kill Castro and to, you know, overthrow the regime that had been established. And, now when all of these forces realized that, and I will add as a footnote, but a very important footnote, that Robert Kennedy was prosecuting the mafia at a tremendous, with tremendous vigor, which hadn't been done before because, according to Herbert Hoover, there was no mafia, despite the fact that he had friends in the mafia, but that's another story.
Well, I want to ask you something, Stephen, because I always like connecting the dots. And I'm just going to take a very short pause here. Just want to mention that we have Stephen Katz. He's joining us on the Socialist Insight once again today. And in this segment of the Socialist Insight, we're discussing fabricating a case for war. But actually, we can see we're fabricating a case for many wars and many conflicts. But now we're looking at fabricating a case for global war. And, Stephen, thanks again for joining the program.
It's always my pleasure to get into these topics, which Stephen, are blacked out
you know,
by the media.
I always like connecting the dots. And I think what happened is the U.S. became a superpower at the end of World War, at the end of World War II. It was accepted by the American public that it's okay for us to be involved in international affairs and to be a superpower. They had seen the effects of the first atomic bomb and the second atomic bomb when they were dropped. And then they said, well, this has emboldened the American people to realize that we are a genuine superpower. There was another superpower at the same time that was on the horizon, which was Russia. And as I mentioned, I always like connecting the dots because shortly after World War II, we could see that it was the U.S. involvement from 1950 to 1953, the Korean War. And I think, and I just want to get your input on this, Stephen. Yeah. The U.S. right after World War II, they were already on the march to become the one and only world superpower, because first they tried to put their foothold. They went to the back door of Russia, right there, Korea. A few years later, a little over 10 years later, they already started putting an eye on Vietnam, which we were there for 10 years, right. And the American public was speaking so highly against that. A few years later, we were back there in Iraq and Afghanistan, and now we are around that whole region, and now we're on the front doorstep of Russia and saying we need to have a defense missile shield around Russia so that we can be looking out for the people over in Iran. But really, everything has boiled down to Russia for well over 60 years. So I'm just trying to connect some dots here, Stephen. Help me. What do you see?
Well, I mean, I see much the same as you. Now that the Soviet Union is disintegrated and you see, there has to be a pretext. There has to be under international law, there has to be a cause belli. There has to be some reason. Now, usually it's an imminent threat or an invasion or an actual clash. And to go ahead and, invade another country that has not done anything like that, you need to have some sort of rationale behind it. It was easy when the Soviet Union was being run under the communist ideology because the powers that be could always say, well, it threatens our entire a way of society, and therefore it has to be contained, and we need NATO, and so on and so on. And then, of course, when it collapsed, that rationale no longer held. And then there was a period of quietness because you had Yeltsin, and Yeltsin basically opened up the country to external exploitation on the part of capital around the world. Then right. Putin came in. Putin was put in there after the Yugoslav debacle, and in order to protect the country to a much greater degree than it had been with Yeltsin. And so when you boil out the ideology, what you do have is you have conflicting powers who are fighting over raw materials, geopolitical strategic interests and positions, and cheap labor, and so on and so forth. And you have that very much today. You have that now. We could see the initial groundwork for World War III, which is now building. Japan is rearming. Germany is rearming. There is more and more conflict with the U.S. supporting Japan and the pivot to Asia against China. And, of course, there's more and more support there against Russia in the competition for oil business and in the competition for influence over Europe and in other areas, and the same thing with the Chinese in terms of influence over Africa, which is incredibly rich with all kinds of natural minerals and resources that are needed in an advanced industrial society that has developed. Some minerals can only be obtained from Africa. And a ready-made ideology for the Western powers has always been democracy. You know, bringing democracy to other countries. Now,
okay, well, we know democracy, that's the big lie. Because, you know, it's even questionable even if we have democracy in this country today. I mean, we have two corporate parties, but we really don't have democracy here. But anyway, finish what you were saying, please.
Yeah, so, it has become apparent, and recent polls of the American public finally show that people have become sick and tired of all of this. They don't want U.S. involvement in the Ukraine. They don't want, U.S. involvement in wars in the Middle East. And because they're beginning to realize that this is a clash which is not in the interests of the people here. And it doesn't... As I said, the most legitimate interest under international law precedent and historical precedent is the actual protection of a country and its people and its legitimate interests, and this goes far beyond that. And, of course, capitalism as an economic system must continually expand or die because it's a system driven by the necessity for continual areas of profitable investment. And money goes where it can be most profitably invested. Money does not go where it can create the most jobs, which is a big misconception and another piece of propaganda that has been perpetrated on the U.S. public and on the publics around the world. So you do have these rivalries, and, you know, that's what sparked off World War I. That was responsible, of course, also for World War II, largely responsible, which many historians actually think there was one war with just a long armistice between World War I and World War II. But nevertheless... So you have to whip up support. Now, back in the Vietnam days, which you and I, Stuart, I think around the same age, remember very well, that there was a tremendous amount of propaganda and disinformation put into the American public. And I remember I was just entering college as a freshman in 1966, And I also remember, in high school several years before, in the mid-60s, they were talking about, they had this thing called the domino theory. And and they were teaching this in the high schools, too, that the communists are constantly expanding, and if Vietnam goes communist, it's going to spread all over, and before long... You know, you'll have communism in Hawaii and San Francisco and God knows where
else.
Well,
we know in retrospect all that was propaganda.
Yes, we do know that.
Because
we
can
that,
see
yeah.
It was just the other way around the domino effect. We have seen it in recent years, starting with what has been taking place in the Middle East. But the domino effect, it was a blatant lie.
Yeah, I mean, there was no domino effect except among the sailors, I guess, who played domino on the warships. But, I mean, there was no domino effect. And, in fact, eventually after the regime in South Vietnam, which was really a holdover from the French colonial regimes, it was kind of a neo-colonial regime. The French were decisively beaten at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu in 1954 by General Giap and the North Vietnamese forces. They were being forced. Now, there was an agreement there. There was a truce and a treaty in which the whole country was supposed to hold elections. Those elections never took place, and they never took place because Ho Chi Minh was Vietnam's George Washington. He was a tremendously respected figure. He was a progressive nationalist. He was a Marxist. He had been in the Soviet Union, but the Vietnamese saw him as an indigenous nationalist leader who was going to free them from colonialism primarily. And the U.S. never permitted the election to occur and stepped in when the French stepped out and, continued propping up the South. Now, after the war was all over, contrary to a domino effect, Asia became and has become one of the biggest sweatshops for capitalist production in the world. I mean, Vietnam has been, there's a more recent realm of investment. There are American factories in Vietnam.
Okay, we're talking about how they've been able to expand as far as economically. But, you know, first of all, if you can't take it by force and you just take them, you know, you just put a little bit of cash on the table.
Right.
So what they did is they, even China, you know, even though it's still a communist country, you know, let's introduce them to capitalism so, you know, we can, you know, show them what greed is all about. The same thing with the Vietnamese and Vietnam. So it's two ways of thinking here. By force, or you know, buy into their economy, because you know, people go from riding on bicycles to riding in Mercedes Benz, you know, or either maybe driving in a Chevrolet, but it's still better than riding on a bike. And this is what has happened. Has it happened in all parts of China, all parts of Vietnam? No, because the living standards of those people. Even though those living standards are higher than what they were before, basically what they have done is, first they were starving, now they have some crumbs, you know, so it's better than nothing. But, it's still, we are looking at capitalism, they always find a means by which they can be able to move into various areas of the globe. And much of it is done, I mean, if you want to think that capitalism is doing well in China, it's not. We still have poverty in China, in Vietnam, in India, in all
That's
parts
true.
of those countries. Stephen,
well, I mean, the regimes there, I think, have a rationalization that they're going to allow development by foreign investment and then eventually. Confiscate the development or somehow work with it so that they can, industrialize their countries. I mean, Lenin did this with his new economic policy, but that was a much shorter period that he did after the Civil War due to the devastation of the society. So,
well, let me ask you, Stephen, is the U.S. a good model of what is going on in those countries where we see the super rich, we see people gaining the wealthiest or becoming wealthier than at any other time in our society, and we see poverty is on the increase. So the same thing with those countries and the oligarchs where these people are the rulers and leaders and the wealthiest in that society.
Right.
We see some of the wealthiest people in the world coming up in those countries, including in the area that we were talking about in the Ukraine and parts of Russia where they did the same thing. But you still have extreme poverty. So it's so polarized where you still have the poor in those societies. The working people in those countries are still beaten down. And not even to take care of their basic needs, but the richest in all of these societies, including China, are doing extremely well.
Of course, there's been a lot of debate as to whether I prefer to characterize China as a state capitalist society. in which basically the laws of capitalism are operative, but the benefits are going to the ruling communist elite, and those people who are in their good favor. And the same thing, of course, is probably happening in Vietnam. You know, now, you mentioned the Ukraine, which is interesting because you have the Ukrainian oligarchs who, with the help of Ukrainian fascist forces, and the Ukraine in the West was one of the few areas in Russia that welcomed Hitler's Nazis when they invaded as liberators. You have the oligarchs with the use of neo-fascist forces overthrew the duly elected president who was backing away from an economic deal with Europe because Putin and Russians came in and said, well, we'll give you a better deal. And it turns out that the oligarchs in the Ukraine, the unelected government that's there now, and that is really a CIA-controlled and installed government, has appointed many of the wealthy Ukrainian oligarchs as governors of various provinces. I don't know what powers they have yet or what they're exercising. And, of course, you have the oligarchs in Russia. There's a lot of propaganda here in the West about the wealth of Putin and the oligarchs around him. I don't know. I haven't seen. There has been proof presented about oligarchs in Russia. We know they exist. We know that when the Soviet Union disintegrated, several of the higher administrators of the Communist Party, what they used to call the nomenklatura, the bureaucrats, they actually, through manipulation, criminally seized businesses from the Soviet people who had created them with their own labor power, and from the government, and privatized them, and they became extremely wealthy. Now they say.
Right.
And so the sanctions of the West, and the U.S. has been leading the charge on this, is to try to sanction Putin. I don't know how wealthy he is. I haven't seen. They have presented no evidence. They went against some company, and I can't think of the name of it. They said that the owner was connected with Putin, and they were not able to provide any evidence of it. And of course in the meantime it's the people who are suffering, and between Blackwater, which is no longer called Blackwater since what they did in Iraq, they have a new name for it, I forget what it is. Blackwater is in there, the CIA is in there, the Ukraine and so on. And the Russians, of course, are arming the Russians in Ukraine, the Ukrainian Russians, who are strongly concentrated in the east, so that they can, so that they won't be, overrun by the Ukrainian right wing and the Ukrainian government. It's a complicated situation, because there's supposed to be some type of election in May, and obviously you cannot have a national election during the time you're having a civil war, because it's just not stable enough. Nobody would ever be able to have a fair vote or be able to certify a vote or anything. And there's some talk that the unelected government in Kiev is trying to crack down on its own right-wing forces and that they're now fighting with them. But, you know, it all comes down to a battle over oil. And all of a sudden, the U.S. is now offering to ship oil over to the Ukraine if the Russians turn off their pipeline. And now there's a split because Europe has a lot more ties economically to Russia, particularly in the field of energy, than the U.S. does. So, and particularly German businesses have a lot of investments in Russia and do a lot of business with Russia. It's a high figure. I forget what it is. But and that's one of the reasons why it's been so hard, you know, to get more extensive support, more extensive sanctions. So, but...
Well, Stephen, I just want to ask you, because we only have around 8 more minutes to continue our discussion here.
Right.
Because all of these wars, I mean, these wars have taken place over the years. The wars, we go into these wars with propaganda. We see Secretary of State Colin Powell, he told a series of lies, and he admitted later that they were lies, which got us involved in this war. Then we had the president at that time, Bush, said, sure, well, you know, we made some mistakes. It was weapons of mass destruction. We knew the weapons of mass destruction weren't there. But, again, it fed into the propaganda, created the hysteria, creating a false sense that we needed to go to war.
Right.
Subsequently, this has been a series of lies, Stephen, for like 200 years. So when we talk about propaganda, I mean, what we're hearing now as far as with Russia, is that just more propaganda that's coming from Kerry? Because it seemed like, Kerry is, he feels comfortable being in this position where he is making all of these statements as far as Secretary of State to take us into another war. What is your opinion on that?
Well, it's ironic that somebody...
And I'm talking about his statements, statements trying to create and fabricate reasons that we need to go to be involved
further
conflicts in Russia.
Yes, of course, they're telling
him
what
he has. In the Ukraine, rather.
Yeah, they're telling him what he needs to say, and if he doesn't want to say it, they'll put somebody else in there.
Right.
It's very, it's very ironic that they... someone who started out as an anti-Vietnam War protester is now going around. Incidentally, I think Kerry has the distinction of being the wealthiest member of the Senate.
He is.
Yeah, he married into, I don't know whether it's the Campbell Soup fortune or the tomato.
Heinz.
Heinz ketchup, the ketchup and all that. But... you know, the point is that it's gotten very, very blatant. And I understand that the Times, and correct me on this if it was another newspaper, but I believe Times was publishing pictures that were traced actually to the Spanish Civil War, which, as you know, is rather remote from our time and place, It's nowhere near the Ukraine, and it occurred in the 1930s. And, there's been a tremendous amount of propaganda. The Russians, I think the Russians are another state capitalist society, and I would not hold them up as an example to the world as to how a society should
by no
be
means.
Run. You're right.
Look,
I don't
let
know.
Me ask you. Stephen, because capitalism, I have said from time to time, and I still like to emphasize this, is that capitalism as we know today, we're facing a global economic crisis. The capitalists, they can't figure out how to get this thing together. The only thing they have left is war. What is your opinion on that?
Well, I mean, historically, War has been one of the ways out for the contradictions in capitalism. And when I mean capitalism, I'm talking about corporate capitalism, and I'm talking about the military-industrial complex. Now in the United States, you know, the financial, the growth of the financial industry and also the worldwide interlacing of trade. And it has to keep expanding and more profits wrung out of somebody's hide or else, you know, profitable sources of investment begin to dry up. So that is why imperialism, you know, looks to be attractive because you can't get out of it solely domestically the way it's structured now. So the only other thing to be would be to take these contradictions project them outside the country and try to alleviate the internal pressures. You know, I've been expecting for quite some time the reinstitution of the draft in the U.S. to solve the youth unemployment problem. The Ukrainians just reinstituted their draft. You know, and as I said, you know, the business of armaments and so forth, and there are quite a bit of tensions, and all of this works together as the, you know, rather than trying to cooperate and trade and, you know, exchange goods and in a way which is mutually beneficial, we have, you know, a pack of wolves trying to fight each other in order to devour whatever carcasses are around.
And what it's all about, Stephen, it boils down to world domination and controlling the minds of billions of people. That's what it's all about. It's beyond money. It's beyond the human resources. It's beyond the natural resources. It's all about global power and global world domination. And later on, we'll get into another series on this, how much of this is tied into what we see happening, how the banks, how the richest elite in the world, it's not about money with them, but they use capitalism as a means of controlling people. And we'll talk about this at a later time. Stephen, how can our listeners reach you? And we'll be looking, I'm not certain when, but we would be looking forward to having you on at some time in the future. How can our listeners reach you?
I can be reached on Facebook and LinkedIn. Just send me a friend request.
And that's the name of your program again?
The name of your program? The program is UFOs, Mystical and Paranormal Insights, and it's on Thursday at 5 o'clock. And Ruth,
that's 5 o'clock Eastern. 5 o'clock Eastern, right here on Aramarte Co.
Right, and you know, Ruth is also on that show as a co-host, and
Ruth Ann.
We had a good discussion. Right, we had a good discussion last week. So
I'll look forward to joining you sometime on your program. I just hope I don't embarrass myself.
I'd like to thank you.
I like to thank you. I'm just kidding. I look forward to having our listeners to join us once again on the Socialist Insight. Stephen, thanks again. Thank you, Ruth Ann. Look forward
to
seeing you next week. Have a good night.
Good night.
Good night.
You're listening to Aramarte Feo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to The Dialogue. I'm Ruth Ann, and here is our facilitator, Ken. Hello, Ken.
Hi, how you doing?
I am great.
So,
we have Kara here. Hello.
Hello, yeah. Kara. Is that all that's made it so far? We still got a few more coming, right?
All of you Qs, all of you Ks. Ken, Karen, and Kara. Yeah.
Awesome. Wow, all the Ks.
Yay. So I guess we call this part two of Moneyless Society. And when we left off, we really were just kind of pointing out why society depends on money pretty much. Am I right? I mean, from what I gather, that's sort of where we were at. We were just discussing not so much the flaws and, well, we sort of talked about the flaws and traps, but mostly just what is it that we're latched to so that we know what to break loose of. And I guess if anyone wants to lay in right now, feel free to jump and start.
I have quite a theory.
Okay.
Well, if we're sitting back and we take money and we take a good look at it, we sit back and we realize that throughout many, many, many years, we use this as a base of, what's a good word to put it? I guess you could say self-esteem. It gives you a self-worth. It makes you feel like you are worth something. But in reality, the gratification that you get with receiving it or spending it, it just does not stay. So I think it's just this false thing that we just kind of allow ourselves to feel that it's something good, when in reality it's not.
Wow.
I don't know
who said
it. That's a hell
of an insight.
Yeah, I don't know who said it, but money is a really crappy way of keeping score.
Nice.
And if
nice.
You don't have it, then there goes your self-esteem. You've got your self-esteem tied to something external. And, yeah.
But remember, money.
Wow. Well, I like about that. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. I was just talking over you.
No. Copal's here too. So.
Oh, cool. Sweet.
Yeah.
One thing I like about that is it's a pretty clear platform of the root of the pursuance of money, you know, because when you're chasing status, what are you doing? You're chasing self-worth. You're applying self-worth to an external judgment factor, and you're not going into your own personal self-worth, which is, that's the great teachings that, you know, that's the core of all of them, really. Was self-worth, and money seems to be the opposing factor of why everything fell apart. I mean, you can throw any philosophy or religion on that one, and, you know, money is the root of all evil. I mean, we can throw a million things on there, you know. It all ties to materialism, which all
actually
ties to status.
That was the love
yeah.
of money is the root of all evil, if you want to quote it.
The love of money. Nice. Thank you. Mm. Okay. I've never known that.
And
nice.
Money is just energy. It's just an exchange form. But it's what we do
yeah.
with it, we feel about it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a tool, you know. And like we were talking, we had a few alternatives that were out there, but it's what's brilliant. I've never looked at it that way. That absolutely blew my mind, Karen. I've never looked at it. It is such a simple dilemma that it's just, it's a status symbol, and the key to status is we use that when we don't find worth in ourselves on our own accord. Brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
I think we just solved all the world's problems.
Well,
here's
another kicker. Oh, I'm sorry, go on.
No, go ahead.
Well, here's another kicker. We're sitting back. We're talking about how, you know, a lot of people really rely on money and all that other good stuff, and that's, you know, a base root, and it makes us feel good, this, that, and the other. Now, the real kicker to everything is the people who decided to come up with the concept of money are probably the people who have absolutely no self-worth, and the only thing that they have to their name is just horrendous, horrible, evil plots. And I feel that these people sat back looking at each other with their, you know, evil intentions going, you know what I think we should do, guys? I think we should come up with this thing to make everyone else bust their asses and look like little tiny puny ants in order for us to feel good about ourselves, because we probably don't know how to eat proper or get a wife or a husband. I think that.
Nice. Nice. In the grand scheme, I've had this running theory on that the conspiracies of the world, and I, you know, like all of us get into the weirdness of things, but I think on the human level, I think most of us are too dumb and have our heads too far up our asses to, and I'm talking the elite, to honestly know the damage that they're causing, and even know the results of these systems they set in place. And I think it boils down to there's greater things tied to their consciousness that have that implement those negative ideas, the control-searching ideas. But, like, as far as the enactors, I think 99.9% of them are just puppets. The old bloodlines and old, you know, things that have been energy that's been tied to them since, you know, their first bits of sperm were thrown out into the great grandmothers of those lineages. I think it's just all it almost like they don't know what else to do at this point, because the families all teach each other over and over and over that you have to retain the bloodline. You have to retain its wealth, its status. And at this point, they don't know better. It seems like to me, you know, that they just don't know any better. And it's an old landmine that we keep stepping on. You know, it's kind of like walking through the jungle in Vietnam. Now, you could still run into a bouncing Betty out there. You know, you can probably go through somewhere in Eastern Europe and still step on a landmine from World War One or two. You know, I mean, it's really these are old damages that have just not been rectified. I don't know. That's just taking Kara's theory a step further.
If we take what Ken just said and just kind of sort of add on to that. If you think about it, with all of the elite people, with all of their ideas on how to keep life here, with inbreeding and all of the wonderful, beautiful things that we decide to just shove in our food, in our water, in our air, these human beings, I don't think they can really... Do they have hope? That's my biggest question. Do they have the opportunity to free themselves?
I think there's an Anakin in every Darth Vader. I do. I swear by it. I think there's an Anakin in every Darth Vader. I just don't know if many of them can, like, break their habits. Many of them can latch on to better ideas. Huh?
Princess Diana is a perfect example.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
So weird that you
tried
just
to
brought that
the
up.
System.
I wanted to share really quickly that I just heard a channeled, what do you call that? No, mediumship recording of Princess Di being recorded, you know, from the spirit realm, talking about her role in coming here. And, you know, her role was to inject light into a very dark place. And each soul presence has a choice here of what they're going to carry, the vibration they're going to carry. And when they choose a negative vibration, they invite a whole host of other types of beings to then either manifest through them or, you know, act through them. If you remember the concept of like the royalty saying we when it's a single person talking, that's literal.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's weird. I hadn't heard that before. That kind of floors me.
Well,
wow.
you mentioned it earlier, just, you know, the fact that they're controlled.
I never thought of it that way. Yeah. I just that it's literally out there, though, and they say we. There's a lot of that, too. I never read into it. at all, you know. I just look at it and I'm like, God, what a bunch of douchebags, you know. And that's pretty much where I leave it. And I don't want to be, you know, I don't engage enough into anything more than these beings keep doing the same thing over and over and over and over. And,
right.
You know, it's an impressive
Princess Diana,
thing.
Whoever said Princess Diana was dead on, because she came in with the imprint of being like, I'm going to stand on my own two feet and I'm going to do what my soul presence is dictating to me, which is to be an individual. From the very time she was put on the stage, she was like, I'm going to be an individual. I'm going to be sovereign within this concept of like multiple beings, sovereignty over others, you know?
Yeah.
So powerful.
Wow.
So individual, and like the idea of sovereignty for the person who hasn't been empowered is the same. It's about stepping into to your role as a soul presence on the earth.
That's really good. I want to add a little to the mix here, too, is that I do actually really glad we got right into spirituality, because I have given some thought to, like, what is the different spiritual operating system is of a person at the top of the pyramid, if you might say, and sort of the, you know, we are the 99% or whatever down in the base of the pyramid. And there's some really helpful terms that kind of help me understand things. One is the concept that good or evil could be thought of as service to self or service to others oriented. So your baseline operating system is quite different. And I think with the inbreeding piece, or the repetition of the same thing, is an inbreeding or a re-imprinting of lack of empathy. If you feel what the other person feels, if you're connected to life, to other people, then you're going to be more service to others oriented, because you can project, you know, that person's suffering or that person's need to yourself. You can make that connection. People who can't make that have a psychopathic or sociopathic baseline, and they really literally can't feel anything but their own feelings about something. So that's kind of stuff that helps me understand the orientation, and then some other aspects of it too is that we were talking about, what does money measure? Well, a lot of people have their self worth, you know, tied up in it, with that, and that's your values. What do you value? What happens there is that you've got you're something tied, you know, externally, and then also money's a measure of scarcity. If you have a lot of something, you don't measure it. But if you have something that's been made of scarcity, then you measure it, and you measure it with money in this particular, you know, planetary system that we have. So what is someone's in the position to make a scarcity out of abundance, they're going to be motivated to do it. You know, so like where we have water is, you know, has up until now been abundant. Now we have, you know, things in place to start beginning to curtail water and make it scarce by water management procedures that want to make a scarcity out of it for the sake of profit. They want to be able to measure it and make it a scarcity when it was in abundance. And that's kind of the machine that's running here, is the real thing that's manufactured on our planet is scarcity. We take nature, which is ridiculously abundant, and we have a machine that rolls through that creates a scarcity of the things that we need. And we're getting down to the things that we need, not just, I would like some want. We're down to the, you know, food, clean air, you know, clean water aspect is a human need. It's like bottom line, you know, the water is probably the one you need the quickest, because if you go without that, you're going to be expired the quickest. So now you're going to make a scarcity out of that. That is coming from a non-empathic, you know, mindset, because they can't feel what that does to the person who has less of that resource than they do.
But they don't care,
yeah,
because looking at all of these people, all of us, as numbers, not fellow humans, but a lower life entity.
A human resource. We're a resource.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
You're...
totally.
That's it's funny, like when you take we've all dealt with a sociopath or psychopath at least once in our life. Every single one of us has. And if you really sit and be in, most of us are pretty intuitive. I think everyone here pretty much has some knack or another of digging into people and picking up things. And the one thing you, at least I found, I'll say, I don't know about you guys, but what I found when dealing with someone, and I've had, in the last 2 years, I've dealt with some very, very, very close to me with business and stuff that frightened me because I watched them have to practice their reactions before they happen. Planned out all the possible options because they don't know how to react or interact with people. And it's like nightmarish to try and put yourself in a place or put myself in their place, watching them have to analyze, practice, and map every single conversation, every single possibility. They make great card players. Like this one individual was phenomenal at poker because he was like counting cards in his day-to-day life. And I would watch him come to work, and he would sit there, and I would see him drive by, and I would look through the window and watch his face. He'd come in blank stare. And then all of a sudden, he would change to a certain look or face and start, like, working himself up into an action, and that would be his emotion for the day. And it would be like, today I'm angry. And then he would look for something. He would find a fight so that he could be angry because he felt like that day he had to be angry. And it was the strangest thing. I could never imagine having to do that. And go ahead.
No, go ahead and finish.
Oh, I was going to say, now take that, and now imagine a family lineage, 1,000, 2,000, 10,000 years of that inbred, backwards and forwards, all through this lineage, and all that they have left is salvage the lineage. That is the pride and joy. That's the status. And that is what it's all been built on. I mean, shit, you go back all the way to Sumerian times and come up. I mean, we can, you know, go back even further, but you go there and you look at the elite, the power families, the power, you know, groups that have been running things. And what did they do each time? They created fiat currency. Why? Well, what is the spell behind that currency? Debt. Period.
Yeah.
There is no flow in it. It's all debt. Fiat currency. I can't remember the guy's name. He's a Russian scientist. He's studying fiat currency. You guys will like this. A buddy of mine, who's funny, he's tied to the mob, which is brilliant, because you want to talk about dangerous, ugly, like, lineage of stuff. And this dude absolutely is breaking loose of it and can't stand it. But he was explaining what this scientist had discovered. As he was studying fiat currencies, and, like, he wasn't looking at how they function. He was looking at how they collapse. And he got it down to a formula that was fairly predictable, and then he applied it to the Federal Reserve, the U.S., you know, like our conglomerate. And basically, we are a couple of years away by dollar value in the trillions, and that is by the exponential growth of our debt, of being the balloon popping and us going underwater on debt and losing our solvency of our currency, the dollar completely flattening out, the Federal Reserve, and the Fed collapsing. And that's by this guy's predictions. We're a few years out of all of that occurring. And then he said, due to that, the federal government will drop off. It won't be able to carry itself anymore. And we're already seeing that. If you look at Obamacare and you look at the fact that that's the IRS running that, and they're already two-thirds shy of staffing handling taxes alone. They're at a point where it's illegal for them to go in and sort through your records for taxes. No agent can go in there and do it unless the money due in taxes exceeds the cost of the agent digging into it. They already are, like, you have to be $250,000 in debt to the IRS for them to even take the time to show up at your door.
Hey, really, really, really sorry to interrupt, but I have a son who is crying his head off at me. I really wish I could stay.
Love talking to you guys. Thank you guys so much for having me.
No problem.
But I got to get running, got to go do mom stuff. Thanks so much again. Have a wonderful night. I hope the conversation goes epically. And be safe, be happy, be healthy, and you guys are all loved, okay?
Right on. Talk to you, Kara.
All right,
bye-bye. So we got this prediction, and the guy's basically saying that the Fed's going to drop, and the United States more than likely will reform as five small countries, similar to what Europe had done, like take the route of breaking off, stop being Rome or stop being whatever, you know, and it break down back into small conglomerates of centralized governments and all go back to state/small country governments. That's his prediction. And I'm wondering, looking at this, and we're looking at, you know, I mean, we all watch this crap, and we all watch how the old dogs are, like, in a corner, and they're just snapping blindly anymore, you know, like, you know, any trapped dog that has nothing left, it's just going to bite and bite and bite at anything that comes near it, because it can't go anywhere else. It's just going to defend itself, no matter what. And if we look at all their moves, I don't think this guy's wrong, and I honestly think that the spell of the currency is getting broken by their own actions alone without any effort from anyone else. And,
every fiat currency in history has failed.
Yeah,
it topples over of its own weight, basically, every one of them.
Well, it's a debt system, and, you know, it's a spell of vampirism. That's, you know, it's if you take the operations of the universe, you either flow or you pull from. And if you look at any group that's tried to in any way manipulate the operations of the universe for their own gain, vampirism, you know, whatever you want to call it, it just sucks. It creates debt. It does not give back. And that's what the dollar does. It's always done that. Especially when they pulled gold out, it absolutely became then, you know, just a device of sucking and not returning anything.
Well, it's a parasite. It's a parasite killing the host, basically.
Yeah.
So the end of moneylessness is going to happen, whether we want it to or not. There's not really.
Oh no, I think it's due. I wonder when, really. And then I look at, well, you know, we talked about like transitions. And we talked about barter, and we talked about Terry brought up the time banks. I have one, and I can't manage it. It's awesome. I got signed up for one, and I'm sitting on it. I got people signing up, but I cannot manage it. But like that, and then I look at something none of us brought up yet is alternative currencies like Bitcoin and all these, like, any theories on that? Is this just another snapping dog, or I've been trying to learn what I can, but it's an absolutely confusing concept for me.
I looked into Bitcoin actually, just to check it out, you know, being kind of computer geeky, and it's basically creating a limited amount of Bitcoins based on a mathematical function, and there's like only so many that can be made. In fact, they were even talking that the growth in popularity meant that they were going to have to start trading in micro bitcoins because it was so popular and there was only so many that they were actually going to have to split it out to a fraction and a fraction and a fraction and a fraction. And it's an interesting concept because it literally moves everything into the digital realm. And so I wouldn't look at it as a replacement for the way we have currency set up right now, but if you're talking about a variety of alternative currencies, it has a lot of good ideas. One thing that's kind of crazy is that it actually is proliferated in the third world because they have such difficulty with their local currency managing the high-tech side of their society. So it became an opportunity for people who are high-tech oriented in the third world to pay for goods and services that are digitally based, so their internet service or, you know, things that are digitally based. So,
Go ahead.
So what we'll have, I think, in the collapse of the Federal Reserve, I mean, I wouldn't put it at that many years for the collapse of the Federal Reserve. The charter, the actual 100-year charter, ran out last December.
Wow, I didn't think about that.
And the other part
of
it is, probably the biggest thing that people need to pay attention to about the Federal Reserve currency is that it's no longer the being traded for oil. It was the petrodollar. It was Kissinger and Nixon hatched the plot to tie it to the purchase of oil. So you had to buy, if you were a country, you had to buy oil using the Federal Reserve.
Japan and China, they dropped off using the petrodollar and went to the yen just recently. Am I right on that?
Yeah, it was 2 months ago or something. And that's the most significant aspect of that's going to affect the collapse, I think, is the fact that now the BRICS nations, like Russia and China and all those countries, can now buy oil resources not using the Federal Reserve note. So that's a huge deal for the longstanding capacity for the Federal Reserve note.
Huh.
It seems to me that the Bitcoin system is just another scarcity system if it's going to continue to have to be broken down like that, because if you look at that compared to an asset-based currency, an asset can be anything. It can be your internal wealth and your skills and knowledge. It can be like the fact that you have a blanket on your bed. It can be literally any construct, either material or immaterial. And you base the Bitcoin concept on that, and it suddenly becomes completely boundless. And I thought that was the underlying concept of Bitcoin, that, you know, it's going to go more in terms of a resource base. But now, because there's a limited number of miners, so to speak, mining the system of the digital currency, there's an intrinsic kind of frailty in that system, because there's not enough flow coming in and out.
Go ahead. There's only so many bitcoins that even can be made. So definitely a scarcity base.
That doesn't even make sense. Like, if it's digital, it should be unbounded. Like, the concept should be, like, you put a certain number of bitcoins in based on, and it should be really user-friendly so anybody can use it. You put on the table, I got all this stuff. I got all these ideas. I got all this, you know, these skills. This is what I value it as. And then, you know, that creates a system of equality right there, because people can, and essentially you there could be a voting system where you vote on what a certain type of skill or concept is worth. And then, you know, if everybody has that amount, you know, it's traded based on what you think you have, and then you have to essentially prove it. It could be rated sort of like an eBay client, where a person has a 100%, you know, faithful rating based on what they're able to offer. And then, you know, the faith gets generated. It's just like an agreement on money. The faith gets generated based on your performance of what your value is, not a concept of someone sitting at a computer and spending their entire life mining a Bitcoin. That's what I don't get about Bitcoin.
Well, Bitcoin, I think you hit it on the head really well. It just becomes another asset. It becomes another highly digitally liquid asset amongst other assets, like you mentioned. In other words, kept in that framework, it's just another asset. And it does have transparency. There's, you know, some issues on regulation and things going on as far as how, regulatory agencies are going to deal with it. But thought of as another asset, like you can, another resource, then it probably fits in that realm pretty well. And it also fits that it's digitally based, so it allows for the digital age to be, you know, monetized and financed, really quickly, I mean, compared to other types of transactions. A little hard to barter over the net, you know.
Yeah. I was just thinking of Waterworld for some reason while everyone was talking. I'm thinking of part of water as currency at some point. And I guess the thing, when we look at it, if there's a unified agreement on whatever, which then that's going to come to a unified community. And everybody, you know, sort of, and the, it would almost be, like, I like the eBay analogy. That was actually pretty good. Like, the community regulates it. So it's not a matter of a true currency at that point so much as it's just a marker for the assets that you have available. And the weird thing, I guess, and I guess it would regulate itself if we were to come to that, and if you're acting as a true conscious society, there'd be no need for regulation, but, you know, that's a transition factor we'd have to all reach to. But, I, you know, I would think, like, here's a, you got a guy out there who says he does a million different things or has a million different things and lives in a box and basically has one pair of underwear and an old coat and somehow has a computer and can get online. You know, like, that can occur, and then how is that regulated, you know? I mean, who is the check and balance on these assets? That would be prior to a conscious society that has evolved to a point of, you know,
it's not really
acting
money,
as a unit.
It's just another thing standing in for money.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hi, Ken. Ooh. Hi, Ruthann.
Hey.
Hi.
Hi. I'm switch hitting here.
Okay.
This is Brett.
That's
Shepherd.
Hi, Brett.
Hi.
Hello.
I was listening to you guys. I like what Michael Tellinger said the other day, what I heard.
I forgot about him. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Remember that he talked about the people's bank, people's currency, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I'll let you talk about that, Karen. But, yeah, something I liked that he said, you know, was about what money really is. It's a promissory note, you know, and it's basically just used for trade, you know. And what they've done is, like Karen said, made it an asset, you know. And that's probably not in our best interest, you know. It would, if that was used again as just a means of trade, you know, like the premise for the Lincoln dollar or something like that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If it was just simply a promissory note saying, I owe you this, I can't give it to you right now, but you know I'm good for it,
well,
you know.
But
basically it wasn't really money like we use today.
What we're dealing with, yeah. What we're dealing with, and that's a perfect analogy, because the going back way back when they started putting assigning tangible value, tangible assets, like as in a coin, to a particular value, that is exactly when money started. So if you disentangle the physical item, which is why Bitcoin is attractive, you disentangle the physical item, a piece of paper, you know, a quantity of gold, into you free up the energy in a sense, so that it's a boundless energy and it's just about a flow. Instead of a vampiric system and an entropic system and a thermodynamically like consuming system, all of a sudden you have liberated all this energy. So
yeah,
it has to be backed by faith and like an equal.
Yeah, if it's backed by something like gold or silver, this and that, which is fine, better than to be backed by us and bonds and whatnot, you know.
I'm just saying it shouldn't be backed. It shouldn't necessarily have to be backed by.
I don't think so either.
Physical.
No,
it
it's because
be,
it,
like,
it, it's a misuse.
Of
yeah.
Well,
it's a misuse of it.
It wouldn't have to be backed. But, you know, you're going way back to when people had, they were trading sheep for beads, and it was, like, easier than to trade maybe, you know, tons of sheep if you had, you know, you've got 10,000 of them. So then you start using something as a symbol, and that's
yeah,
how we got
to. Yeah, just a piece of paper.
Yeah,
just a note that says, I promise I'll give it to you, you know.
Well, one of the things too that's made this all so difficult and an awesome trap that we can't get out of is the materialistic process of the goods and services changed and traded now. Like, everything now is, I'll say, a lot less accessible and carryable on the back of a goat than back then. There's more things that we
don't need.
For instance, electricity. Electricity, you free up electricity and free energy to everybody, then that boundary has been broken, and you're now getting people closer and closer to bartering goods and services. You get people growing their own food. They have barterable products. You get them down to, like right now, we're really caught up in textiles. We're caught up in electronics. We're caught up in automobiles and things where I can't go and get all the parts together to build myself a hovercraft. I just can't. I have to know people, and some components are like made of titanium or made of, you know, whatever, and I got to get it from this piece can only be found in a mine in South Africa. This other piece can only be found and processed in the Southern California. You know, this we have complicated our lives with things materialistically that we feel we need. And it's made life better in one way and harder in another. And are we all willing to drop our computers and phones and drop our rubber-soled shoes and, completely go back to that style of life? Can you do it? I don't think anyone is ready to.
No,
I think we're going to transition through it. I think it's going to stay accessible, but society is going to change into a free-form, free-flow society. I don't think we're going to be able to drop that system of exchange back to that level. We absolutely don't have those types of commodities anymore. I mean, very few people grow donkeys and ride on them now, you know? That was weird to say grow donkeys. That sounded really strange. But, you know, like, we buy cars. We buy bicycles. We take the bus. We ride the train. We fly on airplanes. It's just so different now.
And we don't...
And,
like,
oh, go ahead.
Why should we be charged to travel through space? And why should we be... Why should we have borders and all of these papers? And life is so freaking complex. It doesn't need to be that way.
No.
No, it doesn't. So how do you get everybody to go, cool, let's stop doing it? That's the hard part. How does, where does this start?
Well, we have to have a resurgence of spirituality and spiritual values, for one thing.
Oh, I agree. Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Most people who are, we would consider spiritual, are less focused on material things. They don't have to have the 18-bedroom house with 25 bathrooms. In fact, they don't want, unless they're going to put everybody they know in it. But people who watch that box in their living room or family room all the time, they have a different idea of what life is because they've fallen prey to commercials. They believe that's the way it is. You know, well, it's just, this is it. We have to work four jobs so we can have that house and have that boat and have that motor home that we only have 1 week to use out of the year. That kind of thing. So they've got to get back to some basics. Like, what is really valuable to you? They used to have that thing about, okay, you just found out you've got 3 months to live. What would you do? Who would you see? What would you tell them? I think that that's a good exercise to do. You know, what really matters when you come down to it?
That's a smart exercise. I like that one. It's weird. Like, you talk to people that, like, you know, all of us attack life a certain way, and we've all, not one of us right now is financially well off on this conversation. Not one of us. And we're not exactly freaking out. I mean, there's moments where it sucks, complete donkey balls, but most of the time it's we're surviving because there's better things buying our time. And
we're successful, just not financially successful. Okay.
Yeah, well, because, you know, our commodities are different. And you're right. Like, if everybody were to get on that boat, the commodities would be different. And there'd be a lot more sharing. And then there'd be a giant agreement of, like, well, shit, I make cars. You grow donkeys, you know? So we're going to trade grown donkeys and cars. And, you know, like, it'll be a mutual agreement at that point because the dollar value of these items has disappeared.
Yeah.
No, that was it, really. I was just brain farting, hoping someone would cut me off, so
I want to kind of bounce off something you said. Ken, is the fact that you talked about technology. I think people think like, oh, well, are we going to go back to the donkey and cart days? I would have said horse and buggy, but we're into donkeys today. Another thing to think about was you were talking about technologies. Like, generally speaking, like people like Buckminster Fuller said applied technology is actually the better way to go, too, to get to efficiencies that make more abundance and less scarcity. So when you were talking about the free energy concept, the biggest thing going on in free energy is the suppression of it. It keeps getting discovered over and over and over again. Well, the reason why it was cut off in the first place, most notably from Nikola Tesla's work, was because the guy financing him could not figure out how he was going to make money off of it, because once you give people free energy, then you can't meter it. It's like you let the genie out of the box or whatever. So, you know, thinking in terms of applied technology that's currently being repressed and being applied instead of repressed, now you're back to the abundance thing, because once you have abundant energy, an awful lot of what it is you're trying to do becomes, you know, way more possible, because you don't have metered and measured energy coming from basically oil. I mean, any way you slice the bread, most of our energy comes from oil, which is a finite resource, more or less. And also a combustible engine. Now, I don't know from things, right? But when I've seen free energy devices compared to, like, a combustible engine in terms of efficiencies and in terms of all those exotic parts you were talking about, you know, we might actually find that the free energy devices they might use an exotic this or that, or they might not. You know, we don't even know because the information is not allowed to get out there. We might find out that it really is was because based on natural energetic process of the subquanta, more or less, that the process might have required less supplies than we thought. So, you know, one of the things going on is, you know, if you get free energy, a lot of times you find right on the heels of free energy you get anti-gravity. That's a huge deal. I know, you know, people that are, you know, the biggest cost of our food in terms of the system that we have now is the transportation cost. It's the cost of the fuel. So once you have anti-gravity and you have, you reduce the friction, now you're just pushing, you know, something along on an energetic, even maglev would even be better in that case. You're now starting to have an economy of abundance, an economy of efficiency, which we do not have. Our combustible engines are not efficient. They're just compliant. And the compliance is based on a system where they want us to burn as much oil and gas as we possibly can, again, keep the prices to a certain level. So our engines don't even run efficiently. So, I mean, it's just the whole mindset of saying, hey, get it into, well, Brett was talking about the Michael Tellinger video, and I'll say it was an interview by Franz Horman and Michael Tellinger, The End of Money and Ubuntu, which is the party that Michael Tellinger started in South Africa to teach the concept of contributionism and an abundance economy. And one of their tenets is, if it's not good for everybody, it's not good for anybody. Completely changed the value system and the mindset and the spirituality of how we allocate stuff to where, you know, you wouldn't murder somebody and you wouldn't create a scarcity. It would be almost that abhorrent.
I love that. And, you know, what it keeps coming back to what Brad was saying about a promissory note. So we have a promissory note based on unlimited energy, goodwill, intent to repay on good faith, versus a contract, literally a piece of paper that you are born, your soul, instead of a soul community agreement, you have your soul being traded on the freaking floor of the you know, the stock exchange, and resident in the Roman Catholic Church library, and with certain people holding contracts like the Queen, your Social Security number, your birth certificate. These are all assigned a dollar value. So we're literally working for our soul. And it's an opposite contract of a promissory note, where there is no finite value assigned, because it's not only individual, it's a collective and a community agreement that you're going to hold people responsible, you're going to hold yourself responsible, and you're going to make good on it, or else you'll be ashamed. Right now there is no shame in exploiting others. It's actually considered a value.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
A quality.
Yeah. Right.
Wow, that's...
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, thinking on that, the one... I'll throw the standard American negativity on it. Who polices that shame? You know, and that's, once again, we have to go back to the spirituality tied to this at the same time. Like
Ubuntu is this policeman. It's the community. You feel shame if the community looks down on you for welching on a promise. And, like, you know, if one person they're going to have to leave a community.
Totally lame. What if you got a sociopath who could give a shit? And I'm just saying, like, we're going to be dealing with that in this transition. What do we do with this? You know, there's the guy I worked with. That dude, there was the shame couldn't be processed, because there was no empathy, it was anger and fear and confusion. And so, like, there's a lot of those around. And, you know, like, we could go down the line of, like, say, you know, Bashar and all the other, you know, the guys that really dive into, like, the timeline talks, that they're just going to drop off, and a timeline of this more conscious society is going to break off and veer left. And say that occurs, but in the meantime, while we transition this, is it, you know, like, will it be a 100th monkey scenario where they're just going to give in and cave, and then, like eBay, it's going to function fine? Or, I don't know. It's just something, I'm just kind of playing devil's advocate, like, thinking about this, like, how does this happen, you know? I'm just, you know, like, looking at right now, I'm sure all of you have heard on the news, Greece, New York, the town voted yes to have prayer in the town council meetings. Christian prayer, no one else's prayer, just Christian prayer. And they said, well, that's the tradition. It's like, you're going to have there's going to be people, towns even, cities, maybe states, that are absolutely not going to transition smoothly. Will it affect the transition, or will it just, they'll just get lost in the woodwork and we won't notice them? I mean, I feel like that might happen. But
I think it's gonna affect,
I'm curious.
But then I agree with you. They're going to get lost, because as everybody's vibration is raising, well, not everyone, obviously, but, well, everyone supposedly is raising, but some more than others, I think they are going to be lost in the woodwork.
I do too.
I think it's not so much lost in the woodwork, because I think there's a transparency that happens. One of the things that's happened to me is I'm second-generation conspiracy theorist, and the stuff my dad used to talk about, nobody ever talked about, and now we're all talking about the Federal Reserve System. We're talking about these guys. I mean, I've even seen lists of names of people that their names are on lists, a Bill Gates kind of person or a Ban Ki-moon kind of person, whose name is on a list saying that this person is not acting in good faith towards humanity. And I think what happens is, I think the sort of the measure of the raising of the vibration of the planet is the transparency. You stick out like a sore thumb, because you're acting in a way that's not transparent. apparently beneficial for your fellow person. I think that might be the marker of what changes is awareness. And I definitely see a difference from when I was younger till now.
Yeah, I shouldn't have said in the woodwork, but I think that their actions aren't, they're going to be mostly impotent. Not right at the beginning of the transition, but later down the road.
Don't you think that a lot of people are going to be healed of a lot of these distortions too? Because, you know, really, a lot of this goes back to the concept of entity, where that is literally an incubus. It siphons off, like, the wealth of the soul, and it's tied to money. It's tied to the contract, the birth contract, or what we're born with and under. So on one side of a contract, you have, you know, we're giving up our soul wealth, mostly against their will, but then we participate in it. And if you're conscious and you participate in it, then you're literally giving over a huge part of your wealth over to the system, versus these people who do hold contracts literally on paper, and they're kind of just like, this is the way it is, deal with it. So it really just comes down to a decision point, you know, where people are saying, I don't want to live this way anymore. And you get together with other people who say, I don't want to live this way anymore, and you build small outwards. If there's people
some
in that community...
Yeah.
I was going to say, if there's people in that community who are not conforming to whatever standard of values that, you know, they're abusing children, whatever, you kick them the hell out. They're just not going to be part of the community.
Yeah, it hit me right when you were talking, this is occurring. Because you look at this, where is the most breaking off of the old paradigm, the old tit, is with the separation of the classes. The poor is getting poorer, the rich is getting richer, but also smaller. They're conglomerating into tinier and tinier groups. The, you know, 1% and then the point, you know, 0.001%.
Wow.
And it's like, yeah, I don't know why, but I keep thinking of the movie Zardoz. I'm sorry, but it just will not leave my head. And I mean, if any of you have watched it, I'm sure you have and aren't admitting it, but I'm gonna admit it. Zardoz is a great movie. And Sean Connery rocks. Oh, brilliant movie. Well, it's a future, it's a horribly, like, just a terrible movie, and I love it. And it's this dystopian society thing. And there is, like, at the end of where the Earth is at, they created this, like, this high spiritual society that's absolutely not spiritual, and they completely suck off the rest of the world and have reverted them back to savages and use them to farm the people while this group sits in this, like, utopian bubble. And this one guy decided that he was bored with it because these people won't ever die. They live forever. And he went out and created this godhead, and they had these people that would hunt the locals out there and would use them. And Sean Connery being one of the main killers that would kill for this godhead, and he him into sneaking into it's a giant floating godhead, and he got in through the bubble into this society, and basically created a revolt and turned it over. And I just keep looking at it as one of the best analogies of what we're dealing with, which is the snake eating its own tail. It is eating its own tail. The richer, yeah, they're getting richer on remember what we called it, a finite resource. And they're just focusing on that while the poor is being forced you focus on the non-material things, because there's nothing left for them to focus on. They're too poor to chase the quad runners and the new car and cable TV even. Now they're worried about growing their own food. They're being forced to look at what their free time entails and get more into being happy and not depressed? And how do you do it when it isn't money that does it? They get back into their arts. They get back into their family. They get back into dealing with the community, working together. A lot of them create new trades, go into the business for themselves. And they, I mean, look at it. Like, all of our friends right now who are dead broke, what are they doing? They are going back to the family. They are reverting back to the homestead. They are interacting with friends and focusing on more spiritual endeavors because money is now a scarcity. And who caused that? Well, the 1%. The snake's eating its own tail. Zardoz. You guys have to watch this movie. I'm telling you, it explains it. It's absolutely the best B movie alive. And it's Sean Connery with hair. It's pretty neat. And thigh-high boots, too, which I want to wear a chap. I want his outfit just so people would think I was cool. You guys will laugh once you see the movie.
In a sense, what you're saying, in a really funny way, is that the 1% is providing a useful service. They are contributing their selfish greed and catabolizing themselves. They are actually, you know, catalyzing a reaction within us, which is, hey, I've been missing out on all of this time with my family and with myself. Let me capitalize. I'm just using their catchphrases, their words. You can totally transform them. I'm going to capitalize on this. Opportunity and just build something within myself and within my community that has no dollar value because the dollar is debt.
Like, you know what I did all day today? I hung out with Julie and Noah and the kids. I'm waiting on the investors of Green Farm stuff, and I can't do anything till the 8th, so I've got 3 days. What did I do today? I worked on property. Noah planned out his gardens, and we hauled dirt all day long, and we built a teepee out of deadfall for pea pods to grow in for the kids to play inside. That was our day, other than getting, you know, my boys and running them to, you know, practice and crap, but, like, I spent 8 hours doing that because I have very little money. I don't have cable TV. I got nowhere to go and nothing to do. And I have a shit ton of people sitting around my house hanging out with me, so what did we do? We actually did something productive because we started working on the garden.
Yeah.
It was an incredible day, you know? I mean, like, I am absolutely happy right now. And I've got nothing material to prove to show what I did. And that means nothing to me to even say that because there's – the product is in the time spent and the relationship built. And I'm not alone on that. That is a standard thing. And I was forced into that. There was nowhere I could run to and escape to because I didn't have any money to spend. There was nothing I could go buy. I couldn't go to the bookstore and wander around like I like to with a chai latte and stare at all the graphic novels. Not today. No money, no chai latte. Yeah.
The conversations being had on forums like MSNBC, they're talking about the 1% and how they're actually resentful of the fact that they have to work 80 hours a week or whatever it is. Some of them less than that because their money earns money. But they take their pound of flesh out of the people below them because they've missed out on their kids, you know, graduations or whatever. And so that's a really interesting concept, I think. You know, the fact that they are actually feeling lack and scarcity in the quality of life. And we have that wealth. And so, like, how do we get each other to agree on, like, the quality of life being the currency?
Yeah. I just thought all the bankers committing suicide, and you look at why are they committing suicide. When you think about it, they lost money. That was it. I've lost money, but I have so little losing it. It's like, oh, shit, where'd that dollar go, you know? And these guys are like, I lost $1 billion. I'm going to leap off a cliff, you know, because I can't afford my mansions in the plural, you know? And, like, I'm like, I can't afford to go to the gas station and get a coffee, you know? Like, big whoop, I'm going to make my own coffee today. You know, it just the perspective of problems tied to the amount of money and the, you know, like the, I don't know, another movie, The Wolf of Wall Street. If any of you hadn't seen it, you should watch it, because, I mean, talk about decadence. You know, they're, oh, we're right at the end, aren't we?
We are right at the end. So thank you.
Oh, my God.
We'll be back next
week. Zardoz now?
Zardoz. Zardoz and Wolf of Wall Street. There you go. I think we should continue this next week. Hey, this is a damn good subject.
Okay, part three next week.
All right.
Awesome. Bye.